Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on YouTube channel. I'm Jeffrey Bleich, former U.S. Ambassador to Australia, partner at the law firm of Munger, Tolles & Olson, and your moderator for today's program. Today's program is being held in association with the World Affairs Council of Northern California. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, retired Admiral Gary Roughead, former chief of the U.S. Naval Operations. Sorry to insult you already, Gary. Former chief of U.S. Naval Operations and Annenberg Distinguished Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. I'm also pleased to say that Admiral Roughead is the study leader for the Commonwealth Club's upcoming fall trip to the Balkans. Now let me tell you a little bit more about him. Admiral Gary Roughead served as the Chief of Naval Operations from 2007 to 2011. For those unfamiliar with the Navy's command structure, the CNO is the senior naval officer in the Department of the Navy, the highest-ranking member of the Navy on active duty, and a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. After graduating from U.S. Naval Academy in 1973, Admiral Roughead served for nearly four decades with extraordinary distinction. He held six separate operational commands, and he's one of only two officers in Navy's history to have commanded both the Atlantic and Pacific Fleet. The range of his leadership in the Navy reflects Admiral Roughead's own tremendous range and talent. As a distinguished scholar, he served as the Commandant of the U.S. Naval Academy. As a political strategist, he was the Navy's Chief of Legislative Affairs. That's responsible for the Navy's relations with Congress. As a humanitarian, he was the deputy commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, leading the massive relief effort back in 2004 following the Southeast Asia tsunami. And as a warrior, he has been widely decorated for his service to our nation, including with the Department of Defense Distinguished Service Medal. During his tenure as the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Roughead accelerated plans to procure new ships and aircraft. He advanced the Navy's capability in ballistic missile defense and unmanned air and underwater systems. He directed the service's bold initiative on climate change and alternate energy, including the Great Green Fleet. He reestablished the 10th Fleet to better focus on cyber operations. He introduced programs to improve rapid and secure information, and he actually pushed social media into the Navy. And he also led the Navy through challenges and changes in law and personnel policy to remove Don't Ask, Don't Tell and to make the Navy more inclusive. As you'll discover tonight, he is a deep and creative thinker. More than any other person that I've seen in our armed services, he asks and he's prepared to answer the hardest questions. Admiral Roughead is now an Annenberg Distinguished Fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford, and a valued advisor to many companies and leaders. And we're grateful to him for sharing his wisdom with the rest of us tonight about the criteria for U.S. intervention in the world. With that, please welcome Admiral Gary Roughead.
Well, good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to be here to share some thoughts, but more importantly and more enjoyably, to be able to engage in a discussion with all of you on something that I think is extraordinarily important and relevant in our time. I'd also like to thank the Commonwealth Club for the opportunity and also for arranging for a great moderator, in Ambassador Bleich, who, as he mentioned, was our ambassador to Australia and did so much to advance and move our great and extraordinary alliance with Australia in extraordinarily positive ways. So it's really terrific to be back together again. I would also like to take the opportunity to acknowledge the Hoover Institution, where I've had the privilege and the pleasure of being able to spend time there thinking about matters of national security and energy and other things that are important to our future. It's a great place to do it in a less compressed environment than you find in Washington, D.C. But, you know, I always, particularly on the topic of the night, I always remind myself that in retirement it's always easy to opine and to talk about things that should be done or could be done. But I never forget that policy and decision-making is extraordinarily hard. And when you get into the multivariable formulas of intervention, it is doubly hard. And I also remind myself that life in the arena, as one would call Washington, is never as simple or as easy or as clear as you would like it to be. I've also, in recent months, taken to writing my speaking notes at the last possible moment, because in the world in which we live, it really bears out my Chinese friend's characterization of living in interesting times. And it's really interesting because we as a nation have now spent almost 13 years at war, the longest period of sustained combat in the history of our nation. And we've been fighting a war on terror, which is something that is somewhat new. It's not that clear-cut adversarial relationship and clear, well-defined battlegrounds. So it's been a different time. We've experienced extraordinary turmoil in the Middle East, especially after a very hopeful Arab Spring. We see today the challenges that are taking place in the Ukraine, the contest of a rising power that's manifested in the Western Pacific, particularly in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. And we have a global economy that remains problematic and a sluggish national economic recovery that is foremost on the minds of Americans. It really is a time of disorder and disruption and a global security environment that at best is unsettled. Now, I've been asked to talk about intervention, and I think it really is topical for the time. We look at Levant, what's happening with Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza, the Middle East, where the Islamic State is sweeping across Iraq, Russia, Ukraine, which I've already mentioned, and we're inundated with all of these images and stories 24 hours a day. So how should you think about intervention? My military service spans 16% of the history of our nation's military. That seems like a small number, but for one person, that is a significant percentage that either speaks to the youth of our nation or my age. And I would prefer that we put it in the youth of the nation category. On the day that I retired, just shy of 2 years ago before coming out here to Stanford, we were once again engaged in the same activity as our first foreign military intervention, fighting pirates off the coast of Africa. A different coast. In my time, we were in the Somali Basin on the east coast of Africa, as opposed to the Barbary Coast in the north. But it was the same problem, validating Mark Twain, who had a deft knack of capturing the essence of things, to include the climate in San Francisco. But also, when he said that history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. My career also encompassed a unique and, I would say, defined period in the history of the United States military intervention overseas. You see, I came of age during Vietnam, and in high school, hearing the names of alumni who were killed in action being solemnly read out, being among young men who had the attitude that was inspired by glory and heroism and indeed combat. But our national mood changed markedly. and our experience in Southeast Asia was something that we wanted to put behind us and to never repeat again. But I swam away from the mainstream of my generation and I entered the profession of arms, with my earliest years leading in a military that was stunted by the peace dividend, as it was called, and as we ended our involvement in Southeast Asia. We were also transitioning to an all-volunteer force, and those two things will rhyme again a little bit later on. But in my early days of tight budgets and internal change, there was a consistency in approach and strategy in the Cold War. It was us and them. There were proxies, to be sure, but a strategy that had as an overhang the deterrence of extraordinary power, nuclear weapons. Formidable conventional forces were at play, not on each other's land, but the ultimate end game was far too high a price to pay. We won, but there lingered, even after that victory in the Cold War, a reluctance to engage and to rerun another Vietnam. But the world was moving on, and we were stunned and embarrassed with our inability to rescue our hostages in Iran. The Reagan years brought us out of military austerity. The all-volunteer force that was created in the early 70s was taking hold, and the pride and the swagger began to return. Capital investments put the very best capability and capacity, and I use the word capacity to differentiate. It's an important yet neglected attribute of a military force. How much do you have? But we put that capability and capacity into the hands of young men and eventually the young women of our nation. We had short, quick, relatively easy interventions that reinforced that we were back. We were uncontested. We had a military operation in Grenada and in Panama. The swiftness of Desert Storm confirmed that we really were at the top of the game. And we fought in the Balkans essentially from the air. These were major interventions and milestones, but there was much more activity. In the decades of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, there were 700 discrete times when the United States military was put into use. And if you added up those events, many of which overlapped with one another, in that three-decade period, the U.S. military was used 60,000 days in unplanned contingencies. And if you do the math on that, that's 164 years worth of military activity in three decades. Not all were of the same intensity. Not all were of the same duration or strategic importance. In the 70s, the military was used 170 times. In the 80s, 230. And in the 90s, 280. There were 22 combat operations. There were show of force, in other words, putting a military force somewhere near an event so that you could influence it. That was done 65 times. Peacekeeping operations, 64 times. And by far the largest number, humanitarian assistance and disaster response, 366 operations were conducted. Combat was of short duration. But it was also during this time, particularly in the 70s, that the American people discovered the Middle East. It began early in the decade of the 70s with the oil embargo. And I can look out at the hair color here and tell that a lot of people remember those days, when we saw our energy security being affected by events in the Middle East. The 73 Arab-Israeli War kind of recast some of the players in the Middle East. And the fall of the Shah in Iran and the running nightly count of the number of days that our hostages were in captivity is something that most of us who lived through that will not forget. Remarkably, in the Pacific Ocean area, the largest military theater on the planet, there were only 1% of those 700 interventions that took place there. So it really does reflect its name. There were some other trends that began to emerge with regard to intervention during this time. We started to do what were called joint and coalition ops, operations. So what is joint? Joint is when not one military service, the Navy, the Army, or the Air Force, goes off and does a mission, but we bring all of the forces together. That was something new for our military, so that was a new development. Coalition operations, when we bring the forces of other countries together, we started to do more coalitions. It wasn't just the U.S., on its own. The Middle East continued to dominate. That really became the center of where most of our activity was. As I mentioned earlier, there were show of force operations and sanction operations. And I think it's remarkable that in order to enforce the sanctions in Iraq after Desert Storm, when Saddam Hussein was still in power, that our Navy and Air Force flew 230,000 air missions over Iraq. 230,000, a large number. But what's really remarkable, not one plane went down because of combat or mechanical failure. It defies probability. But what it really speaks to is the quality of the men and women that were putting those airplanes into the air. The big interventions, the ones that we did or the ones that we did not do, are consequential to be sure. But the others are like a bank account. They add up. And they, too, are of consequence because they reflect who we are. They reflect our humanity, our speed of action, and our resolve. The speed is because we are there. We are present geographically in many parts of the world. To be able to respond and to be present with a credible and predictable global force. These smaller operations reassure allies and friends, and they warn and impress potential adversaries. And it's not all about combat. As Jeff mentioned, the tsunami of 2004, I consider that to be the only strategic win in the war on terror. Because in 1 month period, we completely reversed the attitude toward America in a Muslim country. Before the tsunami, there were 30% favorable opinions of the United States. 30 days later, there was a 70% favorable opinion of the United States. A complete reversal as a result of what our military was able to do in that short period of time. And while we talk of military intervention, I think it's important to recognize that intervention is a political move in which the military is used as the actor. The Holy Grail for intervention is the perfect formula for when and how to commit military force. And I submit that that Holy Grail is going to continue to be very, very elusive. The idealized lists or guidelines that one would use to commit military force are good, but the trick is really how do you follow them? There are several that are probably the most known as people talk about intervention. One is the Weinberger Doctrine, who was the Secretary of Defense in the Reagan time. And the Weinberger list basically is it has to be a vital interest of the U.S. and its allies, that we have to be able to win. There has to be clear political and military objectives. The use of force has to be proportional and adjustable. There has to be reasonable assurance of U.S. public and congressional support, and that the commitment of U.S. troops will be a last resort. Perhaps the most notable is what's often referred to as the Powell Doctrine, named after General Colin Powell and later Secretary of State. Vital interests had to be threatened. There had to be clear objectives. The costs and the risks had to be fully analyzed. All nonviolent policy options had to be exhausted. There had to be an exit strategy to avoid endless entanglements. Consequences had to be fully considered. The American people have to support it, and there has to be broad international support. And recently, President Obama at West Point outlined the objectives to those who will lead our Army in the future. core interests of the nation demand it. The American people are at risk. Our livelihoods are at stake. And the security of allies is in danger. These are all good lists, but the eaches are really hard to get your arms around. Is there a consensus and a clear political and public discourse on vital interests in the country today? And what are the objectives? What is winning when you lay out some of these guidelines? The simple question that I would always ask, whether it was involved in an operation or in planning for contingencies, was what do you want the place to look like when we're finished? Still waiting on answers. The idea that we can simply say a particular leader has to go isn't really a good long-term strategic objective. Witness Syria and Libya. What is proportional when you are engaged in military operations? When, particularly in this war on terror, the combatants blend into the public and then reemerge again as a fighting force? And what rules do we consider appropriate and reasonable for the young men and women that we put in those circumstances and in harm's way? Are the costs and risks fully and thoughtfully analyzed? That's really hard to do when the whole objective of combat is to knock the adversary off course. Are there exit strategies, or do we simply lay some hard stops into the mix? And what is public support that a couple of the guidelines talked about? We have men and women fighting in Afghanistan today, and in a recent poll, 0.5% of the American people consider Afghanistan important. Is there broad international support? The last few days have been really illustrative of how people look at circumstances such as in the Ukraine, and how the European countries are trying to come to grips with what should be done there. And assessing the security of allies. I think that's a word, allies, that we use a bit too loosely. Allies are very special relationships. They're treaty relationships. And yet we tend to lump those treaty partners in with like-minded partners. And I think when we talk about allies, it really is important to consider the special nature of those relationships and the attendant obligations and the constant tending over time of those relationships. That's when steady leadership and principled statecraft matter. And sometimes our allies might not seem so allied. That the key there is to understand why, to work with them, and when there are good things, to make sure it is appreciated. Not unlike what's happened recently with Japan, as they've made some changes with respect to their interpretation of their laws and the ability to participate in something that's called collective self-defense, particularly important in the Western Pacific. The other thing I would say is that as we talk about intervention, that governing and deciding today is so much harder in the information environment in which we live. All of us have access to current and good information. It's no longer the purview of elites. Public and private information divides are gone. It's all one body of information. And you see that playing out in Gaza today, where there's broad, instant awareness of events, and the power of a collective voice spawned in the Arab Spring are receptive targets of the information war that's playing out far beyond the Levant. And how does that emotion that one gets from all of this information, how does that overdrive what I consider to be the cold assessments of vital interests and actions that have to be taken? Or does the violence that we see on TV automatically equate to a threat? And that not every crisis that we see portrayed in the media or on the web requires a response. But when we do respond, it is important that when we say we will act, we act, and when we act with consequence. And the end state of our interventions, we need to think about the question that I would pose: what do you want it to look like when it's over? In Afghanistan, it need not look like us. I would always say Kabul doesn't have to look like Des Moines when the operation is over. But recently, as we have put in place infrastructure to hand over to whether it's the Iraqis or the Afghanis, that it's an infrastructure that, quite frankly, is unaffordable. And we can never forget that even after we leave, that the local politics and the history and the culture are going to be a powerful inertia that will take a long time to change. So what does the future hold? I really do think that this period of disorder and disruption is going to be with us for some time, at least for a generation. The Middle East will continue to dominate as we see the Sunni-Shia divide really playing out and the violence that's being associated with the animosity that exists in between those two groups. In the Levant, Israel and the Palestinian issue will continue to play for some time. Our changed relationship with Russia, which I think is unfortunate for Russia, because I submit that Russia needs the United States badly. In the Western Pacific, the rise of China, not surprising to me, not unexpected, is following the pattern of all powers as they rise, developing a military to protect an economy that's based on trade and resources. That will continue to play, and the contests in the Pacific will continue. An area that I think will be increasingly important is South Asia, Pakistan, and India. Pakistan is a country of 190 million people. By 2030, it will be a country of 230 million people. It will be the largest Muslim country in the world. It also possesses nuclear weapons, as does India, as does potentially Iran. And so South Asia is going to be a very, very important place, and the importance of our relationship with Pakistan can't be overstated. And then there's an area that a lot of people don't think about, and it's a term that I picked up. It's called the 10th parallel. The 10th parallel is the 10th is the line of 10 degrees north latitude. And if you go to Africa and you draw the 10th parallel across Africa, it cuts through Nigeria, cuts through Chad, cuts through Mali, it cuts through Sudan, it cuts through Somalia. It's a fault line where there's great friction that's developing. We've seen it play out in every one of those countries in the last few years. And Africa as a continent is going to grow, it's going to become more important, and that fault line, I believe, will be more dominant in the future. Sensational information is going to continue to confuse and to distort and to overdrive decisions. I really believe that in the United States, for a period of time, we will not want to engage in large ground force interventions, as we've seen over the last decade. And countries will be reluctant to accept that American presence on their soil. We will find it very hard to tailor a force that does not have that large ground component as an element. And we will need to be more thoughtful about light, quick, offshore responses to events around the world. The capabilities and the forces and the commitment of partners and allies will be problematic. I think NATO is going through some questioning today, and the next few months will be very telling as NATO decides how it wants to deal with the new security relationship in Europe. The new battle space of cyber, and how will we deal with attribution and response and proportionality when cyber is not a military thing. It affects all of our lives, financial, infrastructure, power. And so how do we deal with cyber events that will be coming, and how do we intervene in that? And I also believe that we're going to see a greater demand for humanitarian assistance and disaster response as more extreme climate events affect larger numbers of the population, particularly those who live in coastal areas. Absent a significant event, I think, as happened in Vietnam and as we're beginning to see, that we will drift more into an isolationist mode, and that when we do act, it will likely be limited action. In those limited actions, it will be easy to commit the force because the force will be an all-professional force. In my lifetime, we've gone from a conscript force, the draft, to the all-volunteer force, to now what I consider to be the all-professional force, very highly trained, very well compensated, and very quick to respond, and somewhat isolated from the population. The type of force that we had in the 70s through the 90s when we did those 700 interventions, and which we as a nation have come to expect, is not on the books. We have great capability, and we see it in a lot of the new systems that are being put into the force today, but we have a shrinking capacity. The capital investments of the Reagan years age out in the 2020s. For the first time, significant increases in the defense budget did not result in increases in capital assets. The last decade, we had a significant increase in the defense budget. The numbers of ships and airplanes declined. By 2021, if the current budget projections stay on path, 14% of the defense budget will be used for research and development and procurement, with the rest being consumed by personnel costs and operation and maintenance costs. And by 2024, again, if these projections stay the same, 2024, the last year of the second term of the next president, all of the defense budget will go to personnel and operations and maintenance. Because the cost of personnel and operation and maintenance are simply crowding out the defense budget from within, and mandatory entitlement spending and servicing the debt will compress it from without. So Vietnam shaped our attitudes as Iraq and Afghanistan have shaped our attitudes. We will live in a world of disorder and disruption. The imperative and desire to intervene or not to intervene will continue. The decisions to intervene or not will continue to be difficult ones, but those decisions must be aided by an unemotional and principled assessment of vital interests, objectives. What do we want the places to look like when we're finished? And it's not just a military component, it's economically and politically. They need not look like us. The costs and the risks have to be analyzed and clearly and honestly articulated. The American people have to be informed and inclined to support. And we have to responsibly invest in the military capabilities and capacities consistent with our interests and our ambition as a nation. So history, I think, is going to continue to rhyme. Monday morning quarterbacking and the partisan divide will still be around. The decisions we make to intervene or not, and the choices we make to provide the means, particularly the capacity to intervene, will determine our place in this disordered, disrupted, an unsettled world in which we will live. And on that happy note, I will conclude and look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Well, our thanks to Admiral Gary Roughead, former chief of U.S. Naval Operations and Annenberg Distinguished Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Now time for today's audience questions, and we have a number of questions. In fact, we have so many questions that I'm going to have to consolidate a few in order to get through the list. We have a number of questions about your assessment of China's capabilities and their intentions. Long-term, Do we see them becoming more capable than the United States? And what are their long-term military and security intentions?
Okay. I've been following China a long time. And in 1994, I had the opportunity to begin, to spend time with their Navy, to see their Navy. And I've seen it change over the years. As I mentioned in my remarks, it doesn't surprise me where they're going. Countries, as economies rise, trade is important. They build particularly navies to secure that trade. The British did it, the Portuguese did it, the Spanish did it, the Dutch did it, the United States did it. So it's not anything that's new. I think that that China wants to ensure that it can protect the sea lanes that bring the resources in and the goods out. It needs to ensure that it has the energy flows, particularly coming from the Middle East. It also is beginning to look at the opening Arctic and the minerals that are in vast quantities there, again, to fuel their economy. They are keenly interested in the energy sources up there. So what they want to be able to do is to preserve those sea lanes, to not be denied options. And in the case of the United States, we have the ability to be able to deny those options because of our ability to control the seas, particularly with our important allies in Asia, Japan, Korea, Australia, and other great friends such as Singapore. So they will continue to advance technologically. Right now, they remain a regional navy, in other words, being able to protect that Western Pacific littoral. They're beginning to venture a little bit more into the Indian Ocean, which is going to be very interesting because the Indians think that that ocean is absolutely perfectly named. And so it will be very interesting to see what happens when China goes there. But I think protect sea lanes, develop a modern navy. We are the benchmark against which that navy will be judged. And this is the nature of competitive militaries, always seeking an advantage over another.
Well, the Chinese appear to think that the East China Sea and the South China Sea were perfectly named as well.
Absolutely.
And there are currently dust-ups over the Senkakus up in the East China Sea and the Paracels and the Spratlys in the South China Sea. How do you see those playing out, and should we be alarmed that those could metastasize into something dangerous for the U.S. who would draw us in?
Absolutely. And for some reason, there seems to be more of an attention in the United States on the South China Sea. They're both, I think, potentially very volatile areas. But I am more worried about the East China Sea. The South China Sea, where you have China, Vietnam, and the Philippines primarily at play in the contested area in the South China Sea, there are clashes that have taken place down there, could take place down there. But I believe that there is a higher probability of those being able to be controlled. The area that I am most concerned about is the East China Sea, the Senkaku Islands, as they are called in Japan, the Diaoyu Islands, as they're called in China. The difference there is that the Japanese military and the Chinese military now are very, very capable forces that can do real damage to one another. They also are operating particularly airplanes that are moving around at great speed, driven by very patriotic, very young, very aggressive pilots, a recipe for disaster. They also don't like one another at all. There are great animosities that exist between the Japanese and the Chinese. And the biggest problem is there is no way that they have been able to put in place a means to communicate with one another at the local level, at the headquarters level, and at the national level, that should there be an incident, that you could use those means of communication to de-escalate the situation. That, to me, is the most important thing that needs to be done in the East China Sea today.
Now, we're talking in the relative near-term future, but long-term. China's Deng Xiaoping was famous for his hide and bide theory that China should hide its capabilities and bide its time while it develops its internal economy before raising its head in a potentially confrontational security way. Where do you see the point at which the U.S. should be concerned about a long-term strategic competition with China?
I do think that China has a much longer view. One of my favorite anecdotes back in the 90s, meeting with a very senior Chinese military leader, and we were interested in whether they wanted an aircraft carrier or not. He said, yes, we would. When would you like it? We'd like it in the short term. This was in 1995. I'll never forget it. He said short term, and we said, well, when is the short term? And he looked at the ceiling, and he paused, and then looked down, and he said, 2050 would be good. So, you know, I think in the case of where China has a much longer view than we have. And so I do believe that what we are seeing play out is a regional strategy, then moving a bit more globally. But I do think that, you know, there is not a great rush on the part of China. I think in the near term, the 7 to 8 year period, there is greater focus on the reforms that are going to be put in place in China. That is the priority in my mind. Should the reforms go bad, do you use the Senkaku Diaoyu Island as a rheostat to ratchet up some of the nationalism? That's one of the greatest concerns I have. But I think in the next 7 to 8 years, the importance of maintaining a constructive relationship, developing good military-to-military ties with China is extraordinarily important as that country evolves and moves into the future.
You know, moving off of China, we also have a cluster of questions about Russia. How do you believe the U.S. should deal most effectively with Vladimir Putin? And what is the military, what, if any, military options are there for us on the table in the event of increased expansion into Ukraine?
Yeah. One, I would say that in the dealings with Vladimir Putin is to be extraordinarily firm, to develop a united position with regard, particularly to our European allies and our friends. I believe that we have to make sure that we understand both sides, what the factors are and what some of the consequences of more extreme action on the part, particularly of Russia, would be. I think it's important to put in place the types of sanctions that can give pause to the support that Russia is giving to the rebels. But I also think it's important that Ukraine think in terms of where it is going with some of its military action. But I think firmness, solidarity among our European allies is going to be extraordinarily important. As far as military intervention in the Ukraine, I don't see that. But I do think that there are things that we can do to provide information to Ukraine that can be helpful in better understanding what's happening in the Ukraine, particularly in the eastern Ukraine.
You said during your remarks that Russia needs the United States, probably more than the United States needs Russia at the moment. Could you elaborate on that?
I don't think I'm the only one that has kind of thought of Russia as really being not in a good place. Their economy revolves only around energy. Their demographic is horrible. It's, I think, the only major country where male life expectancy is dropping. They are losing the Far East because of just the demographic changes that are taking place within China. So Russia runs a very real possibility of no longer being a far Eastern Asian power. And I think that is a problem. the caucuses and the fundamentalism that you see springing up there is problematic. All of us, whether it's the United States or Russia, and look at what is happening in China today, and it really has become manifested over the last few months. Some of the violence that is being visited, particularly in Western China, has all of us needing to be focused on fundamentalism and violent extremism. And so where does Russia turn to have someone that can be supportive in those types of environments? So bad economy, bad demographic, strategically unsound in the Far East and in the Caucasus, not in a good place. They need someone, and I think we're the ones that they need.
Mm-hmm. Admiral, the President's talked about certain core interests that the United States has in the Middle East that could draw us in and engage in intervention. They are attacks on the U.S. or our allies, giving safe harbor and support to terrorists, using weapons of mass destruction, or in extraordinary cases, engaging in acts of genocide. Are there other lines that you see in the Middle East that could draw us in to this conflict that could be emerging, as you indicated, for over the next generation?
I think even though our energy future in the United States is really quite good, the global energy future really continues to depend on the Middle East, and I think it probably falls into some of the categories that you listed there. But the disruption to those energy flows, or if those flows are being held hostage, that would indeed be something that even though we might not be the direct user of that energy, the global market is going to be such that it would have severe shocks on the global economy, and that would affect us. So I think, as it has been for decades, making sure that those flows of energy that go primarily to Asia are uninterrupted. I think also looking at what I consider to be a kind of a new nuclear age. If you look at what's happening within the nuclear world, and it's not just weapons, it's civil nuclear power. But with civil nuclear power, you have issues of safety and security and surety. And what is happening is the initial nuclear countries, U.S., U.K., France, Russia, that's now migrating to South Asia and Asia. And so what is the future of the nuclear enterprise writ large, and particularly of fissile materials? And I think that's something that we really need to start thinking anew about, that the nuclear world is not what it was when it began. And so that could emerge as a significant problem in the coming decades.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program. We're talking to former Chief of U.S. Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Roughead, about the criteria for U.S. military intervention. I'm Ambassador Jeff Bleich, your moderator. You can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see the program videos on YouTube channel. We received a number of questions about Iraq and Afghanistan, which had the same bottom line. From your perspective, having seen it up close and having had to make some difficult decisions, was it worth it?
I think that it was worth it from the standpoint of the attacks that had been visited on the United States, particularly those that originated in Afghanistan. I think, however, that it's in the aftermath and it's in the follow-on that will be the biggest question that we're going to have. What you see happening in Iraq today, I think, is extraordinarily unfortunate. Again, a question of how long and what type of a force remains behind. There is no question that we do not want to leave our forces in place without the protections that our young men and women need when they're operating in that type of an environment. And by protections, I'm not only talking about the physical, but the legal protections. And so, you have the dilemma in the follow-on operations of, you know, how do you structure that? How do you extract the type of assurances from a host country that you need? But I do think that our absence in Iraq is going to cause that whole region of Syria and Mesopotamia to be extraordinarily unsettled for some time, and particularly with the advent of the Islamic State coming in, going to be problematic. Afghanistan, that is still to be written. And the nature of how we can continue to support a legitimate government, a representative government there, will be important. But we had success. Iraq is a problem right now. Afghanistan to be determined.
Now, there are a number of concerns based on all the situations you've described that might require us to be combat ready about America's combat readiness. Some of these questions concern just the mood of the country and the movement towards isolationism, whether or not we can recruit from this next generation into our armed services. Others are concerned about the just the condition of American youth and whether with so many who are either overweight, poorly educated, or have a serious criminal record, whether they would be able to provide the professional fighting force that you described.
I think there is an issue with regard to the percentage of American youth that are eligible for military service in the categories that you mentioned: health, legal issues, just general fitness for service. The last estimate is it's about 28% are qualified for military service in the United States. That said, we enjoy today, in my view, when I retired, it was the best military in which I had ever served. The quality of the people, the professionalism of the people, is absolutely extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. We still enjoy great recruiting and great retention in the military. But it will be a function of, I think, two things. And one is it valued by the country? And are the missions to which they're assigned meaningful? And then I would say, as a third factor, the compensation. I do believe that with this all-professional force that I talked about, you have to be able to compensate people. But it's time for us to redesign what that compensation system is. Because, as I alluded to, what we're on doing now is unaffordable. And I do think it's time. As the ambassador has heard me say before, the current retirement system for the U.S. military, some of the fundamental aspects of it, came into existence in the Civil War, when times were different, actuarial tables were different. And so, how do you incentivize people to come in? And I don't believe it's in a big retirement package after 30 years. That never entered my mind when I decided to come into the military. So how can you reconstruct compensation? How do you provide things for the families of the people who serve in the military? And that is a huge factor. When I entered the military, about 18% of the young sailors that I led were married. When I retired, it was around 85% were married. So as we said, we recruited a sailor and we retained a family. And so what are the packages and the programs that you have in place to do that? That's where we go. But fundamentally, does the country value what they're doing? Because you can't put a price on that. And are the missions worthwhile and meaningful and reasonable? Those are the two most important things. And if we can continue to do that, I think we'll do well.
The other set of questions has to do with how can we be more nimble and take advantage of technology, both to keep our service members out of harm's way, but also to just be a more effective fighting force. And these include what things can we do to reduce dull or dangerous assignments, and also could we actually have more aircraft carriers replacing our military bases and have a essentially a floating force?
That's a great question to ask a Navy guy. I mean, very simple answer to that one. No, I think, as I alluded to, I do believe that the future really needs to be able to be offshore, to be able to support special operations, very quick, very light operations that go in. And so that is how I believe the force needs to be designed for the future. I am an unmanned zealot. I think that the future can really be transformed by the use of unmanned systems. They are not appropriate to every mission. You know, I used to tell my naval aviators it will be a long time before they are out of a job. But the fact is, for the dull and the dangerous, unmanned systems are terrific. We all think of unmanned systems as drones that are flying around in the sky. But to me, the greatest potential in unmanned systems will be in underwater unmanned systems because of their endurance, their ability to go to the bottom and go to sleep for months, perhaps, and then to be told to wake up, or they wake up on a certain stimulus that you've programmed into them. So I think that those are the types of things that will be important. You also are able to sense more of the space so that your manned systems can be more efficient and effective. And then how do you use information and how do you share that information will make things easier and safer for our people who are out there.
It is a very turbulent time, as you indicated, in the Middle East. And one way you know that is when the lowest hanging fruit is a nuclear deal with Iran, then the world is really turned upside down. The area where our audience's greatest fear is the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and whether that will lead to just tremendous violence and bloodshed between Islamic sects for some period of time that will destabilize the world and draw us in, or that it will actually be directed against the West.
As I mentioned, I do think that what we're seeing play out in between the Sunnis and the Shias is a significant disruptor for the future. It is hard, I think, for most of us to understand or imagine the hatred that exists there. And it will be absolutely incumbent on the moderate leaders in the region to lead in trying to diffuse that. And as we go into looking at that future, the countries that we need to continue to support, particularly countries like Jordan, Lebanon, which I think is extremely important, and how do we put in place policies that are supportive, that don't compromise our principles, that will be key going forward. And continuing within our country and among like-minded friends, partners, and allies to be able to provide the type of intelligence that allow us to understand what's moving. But we are entering, I think, a new phase as we go forward, particularly with what's happening in Syria and Iraq, and that will be something that will be with us for some time.
Another way that you can tell the world is turning upside down is two members of the audience in San Francisco want to know about want to encourage reinstituting the draft. And the issues that they raise are, first, reducing a division in class structures that was addressed by bringing everyone into public service at a similar age to defend their nation. And the other is just addressing problems of delinquency that ensnare a big part of our young people.
Okay. For the two members that are interested in introducing the draft, I still... I still have contacts with recruiters, so I can hook you up and we can have you in by tomorrow morning if you want to go in. I'm not a proponent of reintroducing the draft. The military that we're operating today and the complexity and the technology that we are using, it takes years. A young man or woman coming in the military today will normally be in training for three, almost 4 years at times before they're really in the front line of doing something, and a draft just doesn't allow you to do that. I am a proponent of a form of national service. I think that's important, but it has to be done in a way that avoids the caste system so that a certain group doesn't end up in the military and then another group ends up, you know, teaching at being a teacher's assistant at some high-end school in a very elite neighborhood. So how do you do that? But I do believe that national service is important. And one of the reasons I do think it's important is to get to the issues of service and having people give back to their society. And I think in doing that, then you can begin to chip away at some of the delinquency issues that are in play. The military continues to be a great place for young people that are looking for direction. And I think a national service program in other sectors of our society could serve the same purpose.
Okay. Personal question. At what age did you decide that the Navy was the path for you? And what advice would you give to new sailors joining the new Navy?
Yeah. I have a checkered past. So I kind of drifted into the Navy. I didn't come from a military family. Happened to be walking down the hall in my high school that could make nominations to the service academies. The counselor saw me and asked if I was taking the exam, and I said no, and he said, you will. It was a very strict school. I took it. I got into Annapolis. And then realized that what I loved to do was to be around young people who had a purpose in what they were doing. And that's what kept me in. The advice that I would give to a young man or woman who is considering coming into the military is, one, to do it, and do it as long as you are fulfilled. And I believe that if you take that approach, then you will probably be in it for a long time, because it is a pretty extraordinary place to be, particularly around the young men and women who are serving today.
This has been a superb a conversation with you, Admiral, and I just regret that we are down to the last 2 minutes. So time for only one more question. And one of the questions is, what's your favorite personal sea story? You've had a distinguished career over 40 years. There's got to be one.
Yeah. There are just so many. I wouldn't even know where to begin. It is a sea story, but it's a long story because it's a story about the greatest leader that I ever met in the military. He shaped my life in an extraordinary way. He was not someone that I worked for. He was a chief petty officer. His name was Chester Brown. And he came into the Navy. He was a black man who came into the Navy at a time when that was a very difficult thing to do. And I've never seen anyone who loved the Navy or led better than Chester Brown. And he changed people's lives every single day. And that's the greatest sea story I have.
Well,
thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, retired Admiral Gary Ruffhead, former Chief of U.S. Naval Operations and Annenberg Distinguished Fellow, at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. On a personal note, thank you not only for your distinguished service over four decades, but for the extraordinary heart that you brought to your service.
Thank you.
We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. Today's program has also been held in association with the World Affairs Council of Northern California. I'm Ambassador Jeff Bleich, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
That's good. That's great. Thank you.